Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and the podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a community gathering place and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. My guest today is Emily Herring Wilson, author of the recently published book, The Three Graces of Val Kill, a fascinating look at an often overlooked aspect of the life of Eleanor Roosevelt. A lifelong writer and poet, Emily is the winner of the Caldwell Award for the Humanities and a longtime supporter of and contributor to the literary arts in North Carolina. She has also been a friend to me and my family for over 50 years, so it's a great pleasure to have her on the podcast. Emily, welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio.
Thank you, Charlie.
Let's begin with your wonderful title, evoking both the ideals of Rome and Greece and a number of well-known neoclassical artworks. Who were the Three Graces of Val Kill, and how did they acquire that moniker?
There were Eleanor Roosevelt and her friends, Marion Dickerman and Nancy Cook. Marion and Nan had lived together for many years after they had graduated from Syracuse and had worked in the Democratic Party, where they met Eleanor Roosevelt. And they were such friends of Eleanor's that they were often invited to Hyde Park. And Franklin was just beginning to try to deal with polio. He found them great fun. And they took him on their picnics. And one day they were picnicking on the back side of the Hyde Park estate by the pond. And the women were bemoaning the fact that soon they would have to leave and go back to the city because his mother, Mrs. Roosevelt, was going to close up the big house. And he said, "Silly girls, you don't have to do that. You can build your own cottage on this land here at the place called Val Kill, which I will lease to you." And that's what happened. And on the day, January the 1st, 1926, when they invited him for the first meal, he brought them a book for their library and he autographed it for the Three Graces.
Oh, that's wonderful. Would you read a short passage for us?
Well, this is the way the book begins, Charlie, and this is the way it began for me because I had gone to Hyde Park and I began with the tour that everybody takes in the house that was called the Big House, which is Springwood, which was really Sarah Delano Roosevelt's home and Franklin's birthplace. And because Sarah was so dominant, Eleanor was very unhappy living there. And so I went to see Val Kill to see the difference between it and the big house, and this is what I imagined. Let us imagine the Hudson Valley in late summer of 1924 in the Roosevelt house called Springwood in Hyde Park, on a day that began like any other day. The fires were lit, the kitchen pots were heated, the heavy drapes were pulled back, and the sunlight fell upon old carpets. Overhead, the sounds of running feet broke open the silence. Sarah Delano Roosevelt, sole mistress of the house since Mr. James had died almost 25 years ago, had been awake and listening, and she opened her arms to receive the grandchildren in her bed. Then she dressed and called to her son Franklin to remind him that the breakfast would be served downstairs. Then I continued that description until everyone is seated at the breakfast table at Springwood. Marion and Nan are there, Franklin and the children. When Eleanor slipped into the empty place at the breakfast table, between Marion and Nan, life partners, Eleanor's closest friends, and her invited guests for the weekend, Sarah Delano Roosevelt nodded. Breakfast was served from the sideboard, with Franklin's favorite. From his end of the table, Franklin smiled and began joking with his sons. Something seemed different. Family tensions had eased. Marion and Nan understood. Eleanor was happier. After Franklin's suggestion yesterday that the three women build a McKinn cottage for themselves on the land that he would lease them on the banks of Val Kill. And as you know, Franklin was quite a word master, and it easily came to his tongue to call them the Three Graces and to evoke the Greek and Roman mythological figures of beauty and grace and charm.
I can certainly imagine that. In your prologue, you call this book, and I'm quoting here, a work of evocation and reflection. What do you mean by that, and how does this book differ in its form from other historical studies?
Well, even though I did a great deal of research and documents at the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Library so that everything I say is actually factually true, more important to me than the research and documents was the experience that I had standing on the banks of the Valkill Creek and imagining what it was like when, on that January morning, these three women first inhabited Stone Cottage. And so, rather than to analyze, I try to evoke a sense of what that was like so that the reader feels that she herself is there. And I think that's somewhat a different approach from the historian who is rooted in her footnotes.
I love that you use the word imagination there, because I think sometimes that's what's missing from the historical study. And I think that's one of the things that draws people to historical novels, is that they have that leap of imagination that makes it more real than just a dry recitation of facts, if you will.
Well, I agree, and I admire the historians who are writing for the general audience. I think academic historians are generally write for each other and for textbooks and for classrooms. But we have some splendid historians who do evoke. I think of Doris Kearns Goodwin,
sure. Yeah.
No Ordinary Times, David McCullough, Jeffrey Ward, who did the script for Ken Burns' documentary. And we have the instances in which first you have a biographer who combs through the life, and then you have a novelist who goes over the same material. And sometimes the novelist really does bring something of what you call the imagination.
I heard a great quote one time, which I thought had been attributed to Virginia Woolf, and I've never been able to track it down, but it was something along the lines of, if you want to write a true biography, write 4 pages of facts and then a novel. That was the way to really get at a historical character. So knowing you the way I do, I read this book as sort of a symbiosis of what I think of as your twin passions, which I would call politics and poetry.
I think that's true.
You think that's a fair assessment of that?
I think it is, Charlie.
How did your personal politics enter into the way that you approach this narrative?
Well, in two ways, one long and one short. The long of it is that I grew up in the 40s in the South in Georgia, not far from Warm Springs. Mm. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt had already acquired the property to help him get some sort of relaxation from polio. So I heard the Roosevelt name all the time. And I was born just as the war was ending. And so he was regarded as a great hero. And as far as we knew, the greatest president, maybe next to Lincoln. But specifically, I am a political activist, and I'm a liberal Democrat, like Eleanor became, and as I became. And I worked very hard in the election campaigns for Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And when she lost, I was devastated, and I read in the paper that she and some friends had gone from her New York house to Hyde Park to Valkill, where she had often found inspiration. And I thought, well, maybe that's what I will do. And I began reading about Eleanor Roosevelt. It was a great comfort. It was a comfort in part because she had been so abused and brutalized by her critics. And I saw that she had outlived them. And so I felt that there might be hope that Hillary will too.
And then the other side of it is the poetry. How do you feel like your background as a poet shaped the way that you approach writing?
Well, I think that it gave me my style. I think that, as we were saying a minute ago, that my style is more evocative and imaginative than it is analytical and discursive. And I think the fact that I have written poetry and I do read poetry bends me toward writing that kind of nonfiction. I'm glad that there is this recognition of what's called creative nonfiction, though I think it's always existed, but maybe not named by that genre. And I was quite intentional in my prologue that it would be what the reader felt to be poetic.
Yeah. For those of you who haven't read the book, let me just share one sentence with you so you can hear what I'm talking about. This is the last sentence of chapter 3. Remember this, the old bridge, the hillside, the marshes, and the creek ran clear and cold. Now, could anyone but a poet have written that sentence? I get chills just reading that sentence.
Well, thank you so much for reading it, because I haven't read it aloud when I have done my readings, and nobody has commented on you. And yet, when I wrote it without revision and very quickly, and it seemed to me very mysterious, and I was not even quite sure I knew what I meant, but I knew that I meant it.
Yeah, I think mysterious is exactly it. And I think it is one of those sentences, and there are a lot of places here in this book that sort of beg to be read aloud, because to me poetry is very much something that you don't really experience fully until you hear it read aloud, or until you read it aloud yourself. So like me, you draw inspiration from places. I have my most recent novel, The Lost Book of the Grail. The first thing I had for that novel was the place where I knew it was going to happen. And in your case, you've made visits to Campobello Island, to Arthurdale, West Virginia, and particularly, of course, to Valkill on the Roosevelt Estate in Hyde Park, as you said. Tell us about your first visit to Valkill and what that was like to walk on that property for the first time.
Well, it was just about the season to be over when the last tourist was leaving. It was a late October day, and the light was fading. And my daughter, Sally, who had driven us up, had gotten from the car, and we had walked through the meadow, which Eleanor would have walked with Marion and Nan many times as she left the big house for the stone cottage. And as we approached, we stopped and sort of caught our breath, because there before us was Stone Cottage, across from the pond, reflected upside down in the pond. And it was extremely moving, and it was all so simple. And as you cross the bridge, the bridge wobbles, and you can hear the creek as it's running fast that day. And like you have found in your places, I just found the inspiration for the story, and I found it to be so different from the political turmoil that the Roosevelts often found themselves in. And yet I found it essential. Surely a person who was as busy as they were for so many terms had to find comfort. He found it in his mother's house at Springwood, and she found it there. And that's where I found it. Like you, it seems to me that a place becomes a person and tells us a good deal about the person, and I felt it there. It's rural, and it's very modest. It's not grand, and it's not on the Hudson River. Springwood looks down on the Hudson, which, of course, right, is just magnificent. But this could be just any country farm. It's not grand at all. And there was something about knowing that that is where, as her granddaughter said to me, she found relief. Gave me a side of her story that I wanted to tell.
So if we go to Valkill now, can we go into Spring Cottage? Is it open to visitors?
Yes, it is. It's now used mostly for exhibits, and that's because after her death, the children broke up the property, mm-hmm. and some of them had lived in that cottage, because after about 10 years of living with Marion and Nan, they break up housekeeping. The fact that Eleanor has been so long away in the White House and getting home so seldom has certainly loosened the ties of friendship. They remain friends to the end of their life, but they now no longer live in the same place. And she moves next door, and she takes a furniture factory that they had built to reproduce American furniture, and she turns it into her own residence, and that's what is her residence till the end of her life. It's not at all charming as Stone Cottage is. It looks like a cinder block furniture factory that was made into a residence, and that is where the tour is given. People mistakenly think that that is Stone Cottage. It is not. They walk right by Stone Cottage. When I first went, Stone Cottage was closed and empty. And I asked to be shown it, and I asked why it wasn't to open for visitors, and they said that they had none of the furniture that had been there when Eleanor was there. It had all gotten mixed up with the move next door. And at any rate, they didn't have the the money to do two places, the house next door was hers for life. And so a lot of people just miss Stone Cottage. They walk right by it. I would love to see it furnished again the way it was when it was a woman's really community.
Yeah.
I don't think it will be because as we know, federal cutbacks on spending for projects in cultural preservation are really quite severe. They won't have the money to do it, but it is there, and it is maintained, but it is not furnished.
I think certainly when I went there, I was one of those people who, as you described, walked right past it because we were on the tour. And I do remember being impressed by the later residence, and it's, you couldn't really call it rustic. It's just sort of basic, as you said. And then they would say, well, this is where she met with the Secretary General of the United Nations, and this is where she met with so-and-so. And it was a wonderful thought that those people would come to this very simple place because of her influence and her wisdom.
And it's such a good comparison to what's going on today and how people live with such excess,
mm-hmm.
and particularly people in politics. And she could have afforded excess at the time, but I quite agree with you. And it's a little worn,
yeah.
and very modest,
yeah.
and that's impressive too.
When I think about that original retreat at Valkill and the impetus behind it, I can't help but be reminded of Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. And I was a little surprised when I went back and looked it up and realized that Eleanor and her friends actually finished building Stone Cottage 4 years before Woolf published A Room of One's Own. Do you imagine that Eleanor read that book, that she made that connection and thought, yes, this is part of what we're doing here?
Well, no, but thank you for telling me about the 4 years difference because I didn't know that. And she was a good reader, and it's possible, and she did go to England, it's possible, and I will check on that because I seize upon that with great detective interest. I know that the publisher intended in the subtitle of the book for readers to think of Virginia Woolf when he calls the subtitle Eleanor Roosevelt, Marion Dickerman, and Nancy Cook, in the place they made their own.
Their own, yeah.
And he certainly intended for that to echo A Room of One's Own.
Mm-hmm.
But whether or not she knew that, I don't think that it was anything like well-known at the time, Virginia Woolf's book,
yeah.
as it is now. Now it's just, it would immediately be recognized. But that's a good thing to remember.
Maybe we should look at it the other way around. Maybe Virginia Woolf knew what Eleanor Roosevelt was up to when she was when she was writing. It strikes me as fascinating that the Roosevelts are, as you said, this very wealthy family. They could afford to live in great luxury, but they seem to revel in the rustic, from Campobello to Warm Springs to Valkill. They created these retreats that, to me, seem to stand in stark contrast to the luxury of their sort of standard family homes and of the homes of other people in their socioeconomic class. Tell me first about Eleanor's experiences at Campobello and how that may have influenced her desire for a place like Valkill.
Have you been to Campobello?
I have been, yeah. It's beautiful.
Well, in the 1800s, Franklin's mother and father joined a small community of Americans who were vacationing there in the old Clabbert hotels, which they reached by any kind of boat that could take them. And after the hotels burned or fell down, they began to build really rather modest accommodations. Now, when Franklin had his own house, it is rather large because by then he has 5 children. But even so, and it has absolutely a grandiose view of the water.
Mm-hmm.
It is nothing like the grand places of Maine, like Bar Harbor.
Sure.
You don't have the great mansions there. And that's where Franklin is taken as a very young boy. And the important thing is that he learned to sail, which he does. And people on the island work for the summer people, and then during the winter they sit by the fire and probably talk about them.
Yeah, yeah.
And they have a fishing economy. Well, we went on a day that it had closed, and because we came from Valkill. But we walked around and looked in the windows, and it's just glorious. I know that your father has a house in the mountains that really, as mountain houses go, is rather modest.
Pretty rustic, yeah.
And how it has a charm of its own. Just as Eleanor Roosevelt was dying, they opened the bridge from the mainland to Campobello Island, but for all the years that she went there, they went by ferry or by some kind of launch. It also gave her a chance to get away, and she took the children and she took friends. And the awful sadness of it all is that it had meant so much to Franklin. He was a great sailor. And that is where he gets sick, and he is diagnosed with polio. On the way up there, he had stopped at a Boy Scout camp in New York, and it's likely there that he was exposed to the polio virus, which the children sort of threw off, but which he in his 30s, he got every germ. And so Campobello had the memory that was so dear of his childhood, and then the fact that that is where he suffered so. And he was there for 4 or 5 weeks before it was identified. He doesn't go back but once or twice, and so it really becomes her home more than his. And I do think that she begins to think of Stone Cottage, because while she's there on the first visit with Marion and Nan, Franklin is back at Hyde Park ordering lumber and making designs for the cottage. On the way up to Campobello, Eleanor and Marion and Nan have stopped to see friends of theirs who have a summer place, and all of that has given her the notion that that is the life that she wants when she's not in politics.
So for those of you who are not sitting here in the room with us, I'm here at Emily's house. We both live in Winston-Salem in the south, and it is leaf blowing season, so you will hear some noises in the background. But it sort of makes me think about the peace of a place like Valkill. You've chosen to live in this beautiful home surrounded by woods, often surrounded by quiet. And I imagine that things were less mechanized there during Eleanor's time. Talk to us a little bit about when they first moved in, the way that she engaged people in the local community in not really working the estate, but sort of being a part of what was going on in Valkill.
They were always close to the people who lived around them. And after the farming economy failed, many of the farm families went to work in the big houses. And then, of course, the big houses failed.
Yeah.
But she always has cooks and drivers, chauffeurs, and they always sit down at the table with the family. And they drive her back and forth to New York. She takes one of them to the White House to be the cook.
Oh, gosh.
And who is much criticized. And they're very much in and out. To this day, there's so many people whose grandparents knew the Roosevelts because they worked in their houses. Hyde Park, Dutchess County, was very conservative, and it was Republican, and it never voted for Franklin.
Yeah.
It broke his heart, but they loved him, and so every time he comes, they march up with torches to greet him on the porch. They just didn't want to vote for him. But they, just dozens of them worked in his home. And everything was quite modest. She didn't have a fancy kitchen. Everything was quite small, and so what they really do is what most people identify the Roosevelts with, is they have the picnics outdoors.
Right.
And Nan Cook is the person who does the Roosevelt picnics, and they're hot dogs. And of course, there's the great alarm on Sarah Delano's part when they serve hot dogs to the Queen and King of England when they come during the war. But even the picnics, they are not fancy picnic baskets and champagne and nothing like you see in the great canvases of the Hudson Valley when wealthy families are picnicking. They are they're standing over the grill with a stick and a marshmallow, and it's plain.
It's sort of a wonderful thought that there can be a community who doesn't vote for somebody but still befriends that person, respects that person. That seems to be something that we've lost, the ability to...
Oh, Charlie, I just think so much. Thank you for that observation, because I wrote about them because I had lost something. I had lost my sense of America. And I so think that reading about their life now is to remember what we lost. I think that the excess and the power and the money, and even at the time when you're in Hyde Park, did you see the Vanderbilt estate?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, it's quite a mansion.
Yeah.
And, it's
and it was one of the smaller Vanderbilt mansions, as we know from, you know, having Biltmore here in North Carolina.
It's just an example of how different the Roosevelts were. The Roosevelts had lineage. They go back to the Mayflower. They certainly had money and houses, but they never lived lavishly. And he never really had much money because his mother had the money.
Right.
And she dies only 4 years before he does, right. And the state's not even settled. The person who makes the money is Eleanor. She doesn't make great money, but she writes a column 7 days a week. She makes speeches. She's willing to sell soaps and mattresses on radio because she takes the money and she gives it to charity.
Right, right. So in chapter four, you're painting one of these beautiful scenes, and this is Eleanor reading Willa Cather to her friends. As they're sort of falling asleep at the end of the day. And you chose this quote for her to read. I love this quote. "The miracles of the church seem to me to rest not so much upon faces or voices or healing power coming suddenly near us from far off, but upon our perceptions being made finer, so that for a moment our eyes can see and our ears can hear what there is about us always." Why did you choose this particular quote?
Well, first of all, I love Death Comes for the Archbishop,
yeah,
by Willa Cather. Willa Cather has a house on Grand Manan Island, which Eleanor can almost see from her island. And Willa Cather was a very conservative person who hated the Roosevelts. But this story that she writes is about friendship of these two Catholic priests. And it was one of Eleanor Roosevelt's favorite books. And I think, and that's one of my favorite quotations. And you know how it is, Charlie, when you're writing a book, you're going to work in something that's your favorite.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
yes.
I was going to find some way to talk about Willa Cather and those two priests and that quotation, and it all fell into place. And I think that I think Eleanor is trying to recover from the heartbreak of the discovery that Franklin has been untrue to the marriage and his
right.
relationship with Lucy Mercer. And I think she's not theological, but she's an Episcopalian who is attentive to language and is attentive to ritual. And I think that passage about the sense of the divine spoke to her, and I think it softened her.
Mm-hmm.
And she has been very harsh in her feelings about Franklin, as a woman might. And I think that the sense of the divine that he sees in his friends and the sense of beauty and mystery is had a softening effect for her at that time in her life.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier a little bit about your research. And you paint these incredibly detailed pictures of fairly intimate private moments, not necessarily the moments we would expect to be in any way documented. Tell us about your research. What sort of sources did you use?
Well, fortunately, Marion Dickerman outlives Nan and Eleanor. Fortunately, she is interviewed before she dies, and she has a very good memory of what happened. And a very long interview with Marion Dickerman is the basis for what we know about much at Fallkill. And I note in my footnotes that when I quote Marion Dickerman, I'm actually quoting from that interview. I'm not making it up. For example, although Stone Cottage becomes sort of mission control for a lot
yeah.
of activities, it also becomes a place where they bond. And I describe a scene in which they're sitting inside by the ingle nook, the fireplace in the interior of Stone Cottage, and Elena tells them about the day she discovers that Lucy Mercer has been writing love letters to Franklin.
Yeah.
And Elena says, "The bottom dropped out of my life." Well, none of that is made up. All of that is just verbatim from the Marianne Dickerman interview. Mm-hmm. So there is only one place that I imagine, and that's, I imagine Elena goes to the graveyard of her infant child, buried in the Roosevelt plot at St. James Episcopal Church on Albany Post Road. And I base it on having been there many times, having known that service, having known what she had to say about the loss of the child. But there's not an actual record that she went that day. Otherwise, everything that I described, the intimacy of those scenes, does come from a letter or an interview that is very accurate.
So are there a lot of documents preserved at the Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park?
Yes. And the difficulty is that they're all mixed up in tens of thousands of documents. Mm. And nobody but me, I don't think, has really looked for the references to Valkill. And so I had to try to sort of scramble into as many of the collections and letters as I could to pick up references to Valkill. I looked in vain to find what I hope would be a daily record. I hope that they had a guest book that people signed when they came. I could not find that. I hired a researcher. He couldn't find it. And it's really only in recent years that Elena's life has been given the importance it deserves. Now, when I went back, you may have gone to the museum and seen the exhibit, and they give pretty almost equal attention to Elena as to Franklin. Mm-hmm. But for most part, that tremendous archive at the museum, at the library, is devoted to his papers.
Yeah.
And we're just beginning, back in the 90s, Blanche Wisdom Cook undertook the first monumental biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. It's 3 volumes, 800 pages each. And she really plowed through the documents that were there, and so I had that in part to depend on.
Yeah. So in this book, you delve into the history of feminism, you delve into a wide variety of political issues, class stratification, and many more issues. But I think, to me, at its core, The Three Graces of Valkill is really a book about friendship. How does friendship among women differ from other types of friendship, and how do you explore that in the text?
Well, I don't know how friendships among women differ from friendships among men. You would have to tell me. But I know that they do. I deliberately did not sexualize their relationship. In the first place, there's no evidence at all that Elena was in a sexual relationship with Marion and Nan. So that was settled. A great deal has been written, however, about her relationship with Lorena Hickok, mm-hmm. which comes on the end of her friendship with Marion and Nan, and perhaps she has seen that Marion and Nan, who are partners, live together so comfortably and even normally that it leads her to wonder if she wants to do that with Lorena Hickok when she meets her in 1933, when Lorena is covering Franklin's first campaign. She decides that she does not, that she does not want an exclusive relationship. But she remains, Lorena Hickok remains a friend for life.
Yep.
And that's the way it is with Eleanor, and that's the way it was with Marion and Nan. She continued to visit them after they went to Connecticut. They continued to celebrate, as they always did, Christmas and birthdays. And I think the essence of Eleanor Roosevelt's sense of friendship is that it lasts forever. Yeah. And that you must be very loyal, and that politics can't get in the way of it. She has friends who are Republicans, for example. And I think loyalty and longevity. And she says someplace in a a lovely tribute that I found that she wrote to a friend that she hopes her legacy will be that she had a gift of friendship.
Yeah.
And actually, I think it's very important because her great triumph comes in the 1940s when she's on the United Nations delegation in Paris, and she's chair of the committee that's going to draft the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Right.
She's trying to get 53 really quarrelsome nations to come together. And they come together and they sign it unanimously and they give her a standing ovation. And I don't think that her political skills or her understanding of treaties or history really made the compelling case. I think that it was the art of the friendship. John Foster Dulles, the Republican Secretary of State, comes up to her afterwards and says, I've already said some very mean things about you, and I'd like to take them back.
Oh, wow.
And I think that was because of who she was. And I think in that sense, more than Franklin, who was quite cold and distant, the best of her politics is its personal.
Mm-hmm. So it's possible that the skills that she brought to bear at the United Nations, for instance, are skills that she honed at Stone Cottage, where she was learning about the depth of friendship that is possible.
Thank you. You're my ideal reader. You have leapt to the conclusion that I was leading you toward.
So Valkill becomes much more than just a retreat for Eleanor and her friends, largely through Valkill Industries. How did Valkill allow Eleanor to explore areas of feminism that might not otherwise have been open to her if she hadn't had that space to work in?
Well, what is happening in 1920 is women have just been given the right to vote.
Right.
And one of the things they're doing is they're stepping out as entrepreneurs in business. And Nan has always been very good with her hands. She knows how to do crafts and she knows how to make things. And Franklin has always been interested, as he thinks about the New Deal, in finding ways to keep people on the farm and give them a livelihood so that they won't leave for the city. Doesn't really work out that way, but they want to employ local people to make fine reproduction American furniture.
Yep.
And so they start this Valkill Industries. And she has the property. She has, they get a lot of their workers who are immigrants from New York City. And it's a lovely setting. It's away from the city. And they hope at first that they're going to get local employees. They get a few, but most of them come from the city. So they also buy a private school in New York called the Todd Hunter School. And from time to time, well, they make enough money to pay their bills. And it caters to children of privilege.
Sure.
In New York. And Eleanor teaches, and Marion is the supervisor, is the director. And they make some money doing that. But more than that, Eleanor discovers she loves to teach. And she's their most popular teacher. So here she is. She suddenly has a job. And they're suddenly making money at Valkill, at least for a few years. They're publishing a Democratic newsletter. And all of a sudden, that quiet refuge, sanctuary, which they had envisioned for Valkill, has just become a cauldron of activity.
Right, right. So I'm very aware of a couple of things when I pick up a book, whether it's mine or somebody else's. And since I started having my own books published, one of these things is the design of the book. What does it look like on the outside, on the inside? What are the illustrations look like? And another thing is the ending, because I think endings are really tricky. So I'm going to ask you to tell us about what to me is both in your book, and that is the image on the back of the dust jacket, the last thing you see when you turn the book over. Can you describe it for us and tell us a little bit about its history?
Yes, and it's my favorite. It's a picture of a tea towel on a table in the sunlight, and the light illuminates the embroidered letters that Eleanor has put on the tea towel while she is in Campobello. And she's putting the three initials of the three friends, E, Eleanor, M, Marion, N, Nan, and she embroiders them on the tea towel. And those, her friends send them silver monogrammed EMN, and it's a, it's great fun. They love the notion that they are putting there the formal letters. And when I was visiting the Valkill Historic Site, where the tour is given, I saw this tea towel. And Frank Futrell, who works for the National Park Service, had taken this very picture of it, and it had appeared on the website of Valkill. And I said, that's it. I think I probably would have put it on the front, but I certainly wanted them to put it somewhere. So here on the back is the tea towel with the initials embroidered EMN, in which the sunlight is falling upon them. And I have to tell you that recently I went to Hyde Park to read to the locals, and it was wonderful because they're so used to having Roosevelt scholars, and I was writing about something that they all knew. They were neighbors. They crossed the road and came over to see it. And I did something that I learned from Franklin. Franklin gave a pair of cufflinks to everybody who worked in one of his campaigns, and he called them the Cufflink Gang. And Marion and Ann got cufflinks and were members of the cufflink gang because they had been working in his campaign. I had someone embroider 12 tea towels with EMN.
Oh, wow.
And I gave them to the group that went with me and said, this is our gang. And that's how Franklin used to refer to Marion and Ann. So I was delighted. I urged the designer at UNC Press, which has been such a wonderful home for me, to use this in some way, and I thought it was beautifully used on the back. Do you think so?
I think it's great. I mean, I think it's just a wonderful visual coda to the whole story. So we like to end each episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. They're all short answer questions, but they get us and our listeners thinking a little bit about writing, and hopefully, in this case, a little bit about Emily Wilson. So if you're ready, it's time for the speed round. What word do you love to work into your writing?
Mystery.
What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
Discourse.
Where's your favorite place to write?
In my house, in my studio.
Where could you never write?
I don't think I could ever write in the library.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
I never understood line, lay, and laid.
What was the first book you remember reading?
Oh, I read The Secret Garden. Oh.
What are you reading now?
I'm reading The Elegance of the Hedgehog.
What book would you like to have written?
Anything by Virginia Woolf.
Oh. What sort of book would you like to write but probably never will?
I would like to write about my life, but I probably never will.
And finally, what would you like to hear a reader tell you?
I really felt that I was there at Valkill when I read The Three Graces. Mm.
This has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and my guest today has been Emily Herring Wilson, whose new study of Eleanor Roosevelt and some of her closest friends, The Three Graces of Valkill, is available wherever books are sold. And of course, you can buy signed copies at Bookmarks. The podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary arts nonprofit in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks, its community gathering place and nonprofit independent bookstore, and all its programs, go to www.bookmarksnc.org. Next on Inside the Writer's Studio, I'll be talking with international best-selling author of Wicked, Gregory Maguire, about his new book, Hidden Sea, a tale of the once and future Nutcracker. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.